Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The Americans are gone, and now we are in total political turmoil. And that's the reality on the ground in Iraq today.
Investigative journalist Dar Jamail joins us from Iraq to discuss the political implications of new violence there that has left hundreds of civilian Shiites dead and wounded. Dar Jamail is Baghdad correspondent for Al Jazeera. Dar Jamail, welcome again to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, Dori. Always good to be with you.
It seems as if you're clearly moving around in Baghdad and, you know, not staying inside the fortified green zone. Just talk about what you've been seeing and the implications here of this sectarian violence and even civil war that you're talking about here in your reports to Al Jazeera.
Well, that really is the big story. I came in here on this trip on December 26th, and we knew that things were going south in a very fast way because when the U.S. ended their formal military presence less than one day after they withdrew the last of the troops that aren't going to be remaining at the embassy, less than 24 hours after that, Prime Minister Maliki issued an arrest warrant for Vice President Tariq al-Hashmi, a Sunni, under charges of terrorism. Maliki's critics said, well, this is basically a move to consolidate political power. You're trying to basically just collapse this very tenuous, kind of fragile power-sharing government that we had set up, that the Americans had taken great pains to set up. And Maliki's move against his vice president was also followed by his placing the deputy prime minister, Saleh al-Mutlaq, also a Sunni, placing him on indefinite leave. So clearly this caused the Sunni bloc in the parliament, the Iraqiya bloc, to boycott parliament, and that has basically frozen the government. So we have a situation where Maliki is head of a minority government. It can't do anything. There's no resolution happening to the political crisis. Meanwhile, that leaves the door wide open for mayhem on the ground, and that's exactly what we're seeing. During the last week of December, we had the first massive wave of suicide attacks and bombings across the country, killed over 70 people. And then yesterday, we had an even bigger wave of IED suicide attacks, motorcycle bombs all across the country, primarily Baghdad and south of Baghdad, targeting Shia pilgrims. 84 dead, the total from yesterday, over, I think it was 173 wounded. And then today we've had not nearly as bloody, but we have had a continuance of attacks, two more IEDs, a barrage of mortars that fell across the city, one striking the green zone, a couple landing not far from our bureau here, two Shia pilgrims killed and at least 17 wounded today. So the thing is, these are clearly killings and bombings that are targeting a Shia population, just like what we've seen in the past. These are attacks that are carried out to try to incite sectarian warfare. One of al-Qaeda's agendas in Iraq is to sow mayhem amongst the population. And that is exactly what would happen. So Iraqis are very afraid today of a return to 2006-2007, that horrific sectarian bloodshed period where we saw tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, literally just open sectarian war. And that's what everyone is very, very concerned about now and does not want to happen. But they're, of course, extremely angry at the government because the government can't and won't get anything done to try to find resolution, find power sharing, create some kind of a unity government to prevent that from happening.
And so the political leaders fighting, it seems as if the civilians there that you've been speaking to are clearly saying that we're paying the price for this disagreement that is political. You could say, I guess, at this point, we're looking at political civil war, right?
Oh, yeah. It's open warfare in the political realm for sure. I mean, you know, Maliki has pulled out all the stops. He's going big. He's not pulling any punches. He's openly moving to try to consolidate power. The Sunnis are basically in reactive mode, trying to do damage control, figure out how they can try to turn this against Maliki. There's all kinds of political horse trading going on, but at the end of the day, Maliki is making a power move. I mean, today, for example, he held the biggest military parade that Iraq had had since 2003 when Saddam had one just prior to the invasion to try to have a show of strength. Well, Maliki had one today, And interestingly enough, it took place inside the Green Zone. And the timing of the mortar attack was timed to coincide with the parade. And so an AFP photographer who was in photographing the parade could hear the explosion echoing across the parade grounds as Iraq's military is being paraded in front of the prime minister. So the attack clearly meant to show, look, you can have your little military parade, but it still can't keep you safe, even inside the Green Zone. Even with your entire military right there at your disposal, we can still hit you. And that's what this shows. So if the intent of having the parade was a show of force, if anything, it backfired and showed people, look, there is no security because we can't even keep a military parade secure in front of the prime minister. So nevertheless, Maliki is doing these things. He's, you know, kind of thumping his chest, showing, look, I have control of the military, to his political rivals, and really making no political concessions, at least not at this point.
And how true is that, Dar, that he has complete control over the military and any intelligence agencies there?
He definitely has control of the military. I mean, it's a ragtag, third-rate military at best, but he definitely has control over it, and it is a big force. So at least as far as anything that goes on in the ground in Iraq, whether it's putting down an insurgency here and there or a particular militia, he definitely has the power to do that. There's no question about that. But he does have his own private security. He does have his own private intelligence services. He is forming his own private militia. You know, it's not, he doesn't call it a militia, of course, but that's what it is. So there are things he's doing also on that front to consolidate power. But the government as a whole is in total gridlock. It's not accomplishing anything right now. And as we've talked about before, Dory, so much hasn't changed. I mean, this is a government that can't even get the garbage collected in the capital city. And it goes downhill from there. You know, basic services are still basically crap. The average home in Baghdad has maybe 6 hours of electricity per day. I don't even know if that's changed since last time we talked so long ago. Shockingly enough, still about one out of every two Iraqis lacks access to safe, potable, clean drinking water. The medical system is so bad now that people don't take their loved ones to the hospitals unless it's an absolute worst-case emergency. They try to save up money and take them to a private hospital instead because the public ones have just gone completely downhill after all the doctors fled and the infrastructure's just had no attendance. And of course, all of this against the backdrop of unemployment, where rates vary depending on who you get the statistics from and what month it is, but unemployment rates vary from between 25% and 45%. So somewhere between Great Depression levels in the U.S. and almost double that.
And what about others that you mention in your reporting, like the Sunni-led Iraqiya or Muqtada al-Sadr still in this, as well as the rival political group Asab al-Haq? Do they have political strength or support within the Iraqi population?
Sadr is in an interesting position because he's now put on his political hat again and is again positioning himself to play peacemaker between all the camps, keeping in mind that Sadr's always hated Maliki, because remember, it was just a few years ago that Maliki declared open war on Sadr's militia and with the help of the Americans put it down relatively easily. Sadr only came into the government basically because Iran told him to be friends with Maliki, at least for now, until they can get the Americans out and then take total control of the country, which is basically what's happening. So Sadr's a key player. I don't think he has enough consensus backing overall in the government to be a big enough power player there. But he does have enough of a power block and a big enough following on the street that he can throw his weight around and shift the situation to go one direction or another. And that's what we have to watch now. Once again, he shows up at the key moment when things are super tenuous and starts throwing his weight around and can definitely change the direction that things are going to go politically here. You know, Maliki, of course, and his rule of law party being the key power, primarily because they're continue to be supported by the U.S. even after his arrest warrant against Tariq al-Hashimi. He's had the green light from the U.S. on that, interestingly enough, and he continues to be backed by Iran as well. It's very interesting. One joke in Iraq is that, you know, you have the U.S. that Iran calls the Great Satan, and then you have Iran that the U.S. calls the Axis of Evil. So the Great Satan and the Axis of Evil get together, and the guy they can decide on to agree for both their best interests to lead Iraq is Nouri al-Maliki. So he is the child of the Great Satan and the axis of evil. And that's pretty accurate. I mean, if you look at the guy and you look at how he's been behaving and what he's doing even right now, the moniker fits. So those are really some of the key players. Of course, we have to keep in mind Iski and Aziz Hakim and Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani are all key players, of course. And then the splinter group, the Ad al-Haq, that used to be part of the Mahdi army, and then they split off and now have shown up putting on their political hats and trying to make themselves look legitimate, even though they're, of course, despised by the Americans. And of course, now being welcomed by Maliki, a lot of people are perceiving that as an attempt to split the Sadrists, to weaken Sadr from throwing his weight around, which, of course, Maliki sees as a threat. So he's welcomed in Sadr's enemy. Those are some of the key players. And again, you know, not even talk about throwing the Kurds into the mix, which are, of course, other key big players as well. And again, trying to find consensus among all those groups, especially in this backdrop as things stand on the ground today. That's what we're looking at.
And Dar, let's throw oil into the mix and those all-important contracts. Are there any corporate powers that could have influence as Nouri al-Maliki makes power-sharing decisions?
I actually have an article on this scheduled for this Sunday, basically an update on what is happening with Iraq's oil. And it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's not as cut and dry as, okay, we had the invasion, all these Western oil companies came in and set up shop, and now they're just going to make out like bandits, even though the U.S. military's left. I think that's what they wanted, but that is not how it has played out. Part of that's because of the security situation, that there's just no way for these guys to do their work the way they want to do it, with ongoing attacks, with the threat of kidnapping, with sabotage, coupled with popular resistance on the ground from like the Basra oil union workers, and then just the overall population, of course, that does not want to see the oil privatized, certainly not into Western hands. So those factors have been big at play, working against this oil grab of the West. That said, ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell remain in Iraq. They all have big contracts. They all are operating as we speak. Those are just the main companies. There are others as well. But certainly, Iraqi oil is being accessed by these oil companies. They are taking it, selling it abroad. Iraq remains, I believe, they're the sixth largest oil provider where the U.S. gets its oil. So that's where some of it is going. The rest of it's still basically being sold around the world as it was in the same locations it was prior to the invasion. So the key is there's been a big push to get in, change Iraq's laws so that Western oil companies can access legally by Iraq standards Iraq's oil. And they've been pushing for these different contracts. We've talked about the production sharing agreements and all of this, which basically rips off the host country. Well, those haven't come to pass because basically what happened is oil companies went in flying their greed flag and the Iraqis just wouldn't have any of it. And so concessions have been made, renegotiated, more concessions made. And so now we're in a situation where there have been some deals cut, but they're definitely not the best deals that these companies are used to getting. But certainly we still have at least 4 to 5 of the major key oil companies that are operating in Iraq. I also would caution anyone from thinking this is a permanent situation because you look, for example, right now at how volatile the situation is here politically and on the ground, and you think any company is going to come in and think they're going to be able to set up shop long-term in a country like this, who knows what it's going to look like in a month from now. So I think, you know, anyone that thinks, oh yeah, those companies are just always going to be here. I mean, they could be thrown out tomorrow for all we know. That's how unstable this place is. Yeah, we'll just have to keep our eye on that.
And what about security now that you've brought that up? I mean, are you seeing a lot of contractors there now to protect oil company personnel and or embassy staff?
You know, the private contractors, the West, you're not seeing them on the streets at all anymore. I mean, I've been out on the streets a whole lot. I've been out to Fallujah. I've been all around Baghdad, and I have not seen any Westerners out at all. No contractors whatsoever. I mean, they literally are sitting inside that embassy and not coming out. They're there. They're basically just going to be there to guard that. I haven't gone down to check any of the oil infrastructure down to the south. Possibly they might be used for something like that, but I kind of doubt it. Right now, from what I can see, is they are sitting inside the fortified green zone inside the embassy specifically, which you have to go through still to this day. It's the same as when I was in here 3 years ago, which was 7 checkpoints just to get through into the green zone. And that's assuming that you have proper ID and the passes you need and all of this. So they are sitting in there and they're not coming out. And I think just collecting big fat paychecks and escorting people around there and escorting people to and from the airport. So, you know, them and the military, they're just trying to keep a very low profile at this point and stay off the street.
And you also mentioned in this report to Al Jazeera recently that Hashemi is now living in the Kurdish north. So how does that affect this sectarian divide?
That is an interesting twist to the situation, right? So when Maliki issued this arrest warrant, Hashemi went to Kurdistan because he knew, and I think rightly so, that he would not get a fair trial under Maliki's justice system because Maliki controls the courts and everyone here knows it. So Maliki made the order, the court issues the warrant, and it's out there. And so Hashemi, you know, he's going to go through the kangaroo court and end up in one of Maliki's dungeons or executed on charges of terrorism for assassination attempts and running death squads are the charges. Or he goes up to Kurdistan, and now he's staying in Talabani's house up in Kurdistan, because the Kurdish region is basically a very semi-autonomous region in that Baghdad doesn't really have authority there. They can't. And there's another big squabble brewing between Kirkuk and the oil fields there, and do the Kurds get it or how much control of Baghdad has over it? But that's a whole nother story, probably a whole separate discussion. But Hashemi staying up there in Talabani's house is interesting because it puts the Kurds, obviously, in a position of playing mediator. Kurds saying, look, we're not going to hand this guy over. We want him to have a fair trial, too, wherever that might be. So he's sitting up there. Of course, the Maliki government has gone so far as to accuse Talabani at one point of being a terrorist or housing a terrorist. And then, of course, all hell was raised politically about that by the Kurds. And so the Maliki group withdrew that statement to calm things down a bit. But that's how the situation's been playing out. It's really quite the mess. There is supposed to be a meeting at some point at Talabani's house here in Baghdad to bring all the groups together to talk about the situation, to try to find resolution. However, Maliki has already said, well, yeah, we agree to have this meeting, but only on the condition that we don't talk about Hashemi. And so what's the point? So there's that obstacle coupled with numerous other obstacles, like Sadr already said, look, if the Adal-Haq group shows up, our rival group shows up, we won't show up. There's that issue. There's the issue of, well, Hashemi can't be there because he's up in Kurdistan. I mean, there's numerous issues like this that if this meeting even takes place, when it takes place, it's got many, many major obstacles to overcome before anything productive might come of it.
And Dar, what about the Grand Ayatollah Sistani? Could he play a role as he did during earlier years of the U.S. occupation when he tried to, you know, wage peace by bringing groups together to meet?
He has not. He has been a background figure. We haven't been hearing his name at all in Baghdad. And I think, you know, basically he hasn't really had to do anything because for the most part, if we still look at the overall situation, the Shia have the majority in the government, the majority of the country now, geographically and politically and population-wise, is now either directly or indirectly under the control of Iran. And they've accomplished all this without even having to fire a shot. And I think it's been by making very smooth and politically savvy realpolitik moves behind the scenes oftentimes. And they've been doing that from the very beginning. And the thing that we've talked about in the past too, Dory, that, you know, Iran was playing chess from the start and the U.S. at best was playing checkers. So we have the U.S. come in, invade the country illegally, destroy its reputation, destroy the military, tank the economy, kill 4,500 American troops, spend almost $1 trillion just in overt hard costs, not even looking down the future of other costs. So many studies have been done calling this a $3 trillion war, et cetera. Go through all that and then withdraw humiliated when you can't get diplomatic immunity for your troops to remain in country and leave without the oil companies having the total access to the oil that they wanted and basically just taking what you can get because your empire is crumbling. Meanwhile, Iran has garnered so so much control and hegemony over so much of Iraq at your expense. I mean, that's basically what's happened here. It's been a pretty remarkable thing to witness. I mean, if you go around Baghdad now, it's really amazing. The Shia flags were coming up on Ashura. It's Shia holy time. And the Imam Hussein flags are flying everywhere. They're at the airport, everywhere you go, every government building, on government vehicles, half of them driving around in the streets are flying the flags. The statement is clear. The Shia are in control here.
And the U.S. arriving in Baghdad with a de-Ba'athification plan in hand. Just talk about the consequences, though, to Iraq overall as you return after some time away from the country.
Well, the most important statistic, as we've talked about so many times, Dory, is how many Iraqis have paid for this disaster with their lives. I always stick with the baseline being the Landsat report that came out in 2006 at 655,000 deaths. That's now grossly out of date, even though it's the only scientific study. It's grossly out of date. So now we have the OMB study out of London, which pegged it at 1.1 million. And then we have Just Foreign Policy that tries to keep it running tab. And they're up to, I think, 1.4 million now. And that's not even talking about wounded. That's the people who have died directly or indirectly as a result of the occupation. So those are the figures we need to talk about. Anything lower than the Landsat is not a viable figure. They're statistically unsound, and we have to remember the only scientific study that's actually been done. There's been two, and they've both been done by the Landsat. The 2004 study that came out that was 98,000, and then the 2006 study that pegged it at 655,000. So that's what we're talking about as far as what it's cost the Iraqi people, and that's just mind-boggling. I mean, 1 million people out of a country of 20, one out of every 27 people have been killed is what we're talking about. Secondary to that, you know, we talk about people displaced from their homes. To this day, we have at least 1 million people internally displaced from their homes. At least 1 million people remain externally displaced from their homes in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and then go down the longer list of countries from those top three. And then the infrastructure destruction that I talked about, lack of water, lack of electricity, lack of jobs, lack of security. It's a hard story to report because I feel like I'm saying the same things to you now as our very, very first interview back in 2003, Dory, except I just keep adjusting the figures upwards. And that's what the story is in Iraq, is it really is still that bad here. People are not making a living. It's an extremely difficult existence. I mean, I was over, just to give you an idea, I mean, I was over in Sadr City 2 days before the bombings happened yesterday. And I know that I went right by that place where the motorcycle bombs happened, where those day laborers gather, have some tea, and then they get on the bus when they find some work, and they go do their day's work, and they earn a little bit of pay to hopefully feed their family for one more day. And that's how about half the people in that entire area live. And that's half the population of Baghdad, between 3 and 3.5 million people. So those people are out there waiting to get one day's work, and then they're blown up. So what about those families? Think about this. And I was just over there talking to these people in a market. You know, I talked to a woman selling fruit. She's the only person in her family with a job. They didn't eat dinner last night. I mean, that's how most people here are trying to eke out an existence. It really, truly is that bad. The Americans are gone, and now we are in total political turmoil. And that's the reality on the ground in Iraq today.
Well, and we were talking about Fallujah, which I know you were there several times during sieges, and if you use that, too, as a barometer of how people are doing, what is the story out of Fallujah today?
I published a piece a couple of days ago about overall situation in Fallujah, about how, you know, we're looking at a place, the consensus there's probably between 70 and 80% unemployment. The city, big parts of it still look like it was just bombed. There's still basically no infrastructure. Maybe in 1 to 4 hours of electricity per day in the average house. Clean drinking water, forget about it. Working functional sewage, forget about it. Security, forget about it. There's attacks daily in the city. And people are angry. They're glad the Americans are gone, but they're bitter. There's, of course, been very little compensation in the wake of the sieges. Most people didn't get compensation for destroyed houses or livelihoods or anything like that. Keeping in mind, 6,000 businesses were destroyed during the second siege alone. So think about that. On top of that, I think one of the more horrifying situations, and I had a story just published on this, today is the absolutely catastrophic levels of birth defects and abnormalities in Fallujah newborns. I spoke with Dr. Samira Alani. She's a pediatric specialist at the main hospital there at Fallujah General. She's been there since 1997. The Ministry of Health out of Baghdad won't take up responsibility of cataloging these defects. And this is a political statement in itself. This tells you who's running government and who cares about Fallujah and who doesn't, right? So Maliki hates Fallujah. So there you have it. Alani herself has taken it upon herself to start logging the number of birth defect cases that she come across. And she started doing this in October of 2009. And just her alone, since 2009, has logged 699 cases of birth defects. And when she tallies that out for the overall population, she's looking at just over a 14% rate of people having babies are having babies with birth defects. And by comparison, she was in Japan a couple of months ago, and she met with Japanese doctors who'd done long-term studies of radiation and cancers and birth defects in the wake of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And over there, at their peak, they had 1% to 2% rate of birth defects. In Fallujah, it's over 14%, between 14 and 15%. So that gives you an idea of how much radiation and how much toxic chemical poisoning there is in Fallujah. And this is definitely one of the harder stories I've had to write in a long time. I mean, I saw many of these kids, many of these babies with my own eyes. Most of the really, really horrific defects, they die within, either they're dead when they're born or they die within 20 to 30 minutes. So Dr. Alani showed me pictures and gave me a flash drive with way more than I wanted to look at. But we were able to put a couple up on the website of the not the worst cases, but bad enough so that people get an idea. I mean, we're talking about abnormalities that are something out of a horror movie. And people are now afraid to have babies in Fallujah. It's a crisis situation. I mean, what do people do? And it was hard to go to Fallujah also because, you know, I've seen that town. Yeah, I was in there long before the first siege ever took place. I've seen it gone from being a functional, vibrant city, one with a lot of pride, known as the City of Moss, to one that's been largely destroyed. And you go in there now and there's no economy and people don't know what they're going to do. And look, if people are going to stop having kids, I mean, how long does it take for the city to go away? I mean, maybe that's what we're in the process of witnessing happening, where there's going to be a massive demographic shift longer term. But ironically, a different thing that's happening at the same time is that because of the sectarian fears rising in Baghdad, once again, people who live in mixed Shia-Sunni neighborhoods, a lot of the Sunnis are leaving, and they're going to places where they know it's safe for Sunnis, and one of those places is Fallujah. So Fallujah right now actually is full of people, because so many people from Baghdad have gone up there and running for their lives to go up there and just work as day laborers, because they feel like it's safer for them to live in Fallujah than it is to live in Baghdad.
Dar Jamil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again, Dori. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Award-winning investigative journalist Dar Jamil is author of Beyond the Green Zone, as well as The Will to Resist. He has been covering Iraq off and on since 2003, and we reached him in Baghdad, where he is Al Jazeera's correspondent there. You can find his work at Al Jazeera English and Interpress Service, Truth Out, The Nation, The Sunday Herald in Scotland, The Guardian, Foreign Policy in Focus, Le Monde Diplomatique, The Independent, as well as other publications, or go to his website, darjamil.net. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org is our website. Our music is by Fritz Heed.